The following talk was given by Randy Potterbaum at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on February 8, 2026. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. When Steve contacted me a few months ago about giving this talk, I had recently been approached by a young man, well, young is relative, of course, actually a young chaplain that I had been doing some volunteer work with, and he told me that he had heard from one of the other chaplains that I wasn't a Christian, that I was a Buddhist, and so he wanted to ask me some questions about that, and we had a very nice conversation. Bright young man, Princeton Divinity School graduate, so knows what he's talking about. But what that reminded me of was similar conversations that I've had over the years. Most of them really were 20 or 30 years ago. I'd be at some kind of gathering and get identified as someone who was a follower of the middle way, and people would have some questions. There was a wide range of questions. I recall a lot of questions about reincarnation, and actually there seemed to be a lot of people who were disappointed that not all Buddhists hold the same ideas about it as, say, Tibetans or Nepalese Buddhists do. There were questions about enlightenment. Sometimes people would ask if the Buddha was a god or a prophet. Questions about meditation, or whether all Buddhists were vegetarian, or whether all Buddhists were pacifists, those kinds of things. You all probably have had similar conversations. And I'll say I did try to answer those questions in a very careful manner. But there was one question that had a little more weight to it. And it was a question that typically came from people of faith. And that's the question that we want to talk about today. And it was various examples of this question. What is the most important thing about Buddhist practice? Now, to me, that's a pretty serious question, right to the heart of the matter. And while I was careful in how I answered some of those other questions, which were a little lighter, I was very careful about what I said about what the most important thing would be about a Buddhist practice. If I was talking to this group, I would just say the most important thing is karma. But that's not a term I would use in most settings, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. What I would tell people who ask me what the most important thing was, something along these lines. The most important thing about a Buddhist practice is how we choose to live our lives. It's being thoughtful, mindful, intentional about what we do. It's being careful not to cause harm to other people and try to treat people in a way that's helpful to them. It's being thoughtful, mindful, intentional about what we say and how we say it. Again, with the idea that we want to be helpful to others, you know, not cause any unnecessary suffering. And it's being thoughtful, mindful, intentional about how we treat all the beings and all the creatures in our environment, as well as the environment itself. And in response to my response to their questions, we had a lot of, I think, very meaningful conversations about what is held in common among various religious or spiritual practices. I always tried to steer those conversations away from any thoughts about differences, because as soon as we start talking about differences, people take up positions. It's not an equal conversation. Us and them arises. So I will just talk today a little bit more about that question. Now let me speak about why I really don't use that term karma in most settings. And it's because there's so many different ideas about it. One kind of common idea I seem to run across is the view that karma is some kind of cosmic force kind of circling around the universe waiting to kind of pounce down and get revenge on someone who misbehaves, which is an interesting philosophy, not particularly consistent with my thoughts. And if you do even a cursory study in how karma is viewed in some religions, some practices, particularly Hindu or some Buddhist sects, it gets very complicated. You know, you'll find the 10 rules of karma, the conditions of karma, the types of karma, which is all fine. It's just that it seemed a little complicated to me. You may run across the idea that each of us is a storehouse of karma, and all of our good and bad karma is stored within us. And then when we die, it gets weighed out. And if the good outweighs the bad, our next life is better than this one. The bad outweighs the good, our next life is not so great. Again, great philosophy, although not particularly consistent with my thoughts. So for the purpose of this talk, excuse me. Karma is simply, it's our intentional actions, it's our intentional speech, all of which result from the conditions of our mind. And there are lots of teachings about that in the sutras from the ancients, from current teachers. I'm just going to review a few of those. And all of these, I think, are teachings most of you are very familiar with. The first one comes from the, and I have a hard time pronouncing this, Upajanhatthana Sutra, which fortunately for me is also called the Subjects of Contemplation Sutra. So I prefer that, the English version of that. There's lots of versions out there, lots of interpretations. And we know that as the five remembrances. And the one that I'm going to cite today comes from the late Vietnamese Buddhist teacher, Reverend Nhat Hanh, Thich Nhat Hanh. And even if you were, say, to Google his versions of it, you'll come up with some different versions. But they all say the same thing, right? They all point to the same thing. The first three of the remembrances are really the things that the historical Buddha, actually, was before he became the Buddha, things that he noticed that were part of his motivation to seek out the truth about his true nature. And they are as follows. I am of a nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. I am of a nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape ill health. I am of a nature to die. There is no way to escape death. Old age, ill health, and death, three fairly dramatic examples of impermanence. But probably beyond dramatic. Death is, I think, a pretty beyond dramatic example. The fourth remembrance points to the universality of impermanence. And this is how he recites it. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of a nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. Again, the universality of impermanence. If we take the time to contemplate those first four remembrances, we have an opportunity to have some clarity of mind around about impermanence. And maybe this is just logical, but if we have clarity of mind about impermanence, our actions, the way we choose to live our life, will reflect that. The fifth remembrance goes like this. My karma is my only true belonging. I cannot escape the consequences of my karma. My karma is the ground upon which I stand. And you might hear this as my intentional actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my intentional actions. my actions are the ground upon which I stand. Again, I think a very profound teaching about understanding our true nature, particularly in this case, the impermanence of our nature. And in doing so, we have an opportunity for how we choose to live our life to reflect that understanding. The next teaching, again, I think probably all of you have run across this. There is a simple way to become a Buddha. When you refrain from unwholesome actions, are not attached to birth and death, and are compassionate towards all sentient beings, respectful to seniors and kind to juniors, not excluding or desiring anything, with no designing thoughts or worries, you will be called a Buddha. Do not seek anything else. It's very well put. There's a simpler version of that that you probably also have heard. It goes like this. Do what is wholesome, avoid what is unwholesome, and you will be called a Buddha. That sounds fairly simple. You know, do what is wholesome, avoid what is unwholesome. The rub really kind comes in understanding what is wholesome, what is unwholesome. That requires some effort, and it gets to be very complicated. There are some teachings about that. There's one teaching that I think, and we all know, it's called the three poisons. There's greed, which we would also refer to as desire or want. There is the agitated mind that comes with anger. And there is ignorance, which we'll call delusion. And I'll talk a little bit about that. The first one, greed, if you just look at it from the semantics, there's probably nothing we call greed that would be wholesome. At least I'd be hard-pressed to come up with wholesome. Yes, but then the question arises, how do we determine what's wholesome and what's unwholesome with our desires, our wants? It gets a bit complicated. I think sometimes we might tend to think that all of our desires and all of our wants are unwholesome, but that's certainly not the case. You know, all of us want to have a peaceful life. We want to have basic creature comforts. We want to have a place to live, want to have nutrition. We want to have good relationships with our family, with our friends. We want to belong to a supportive community. We want those things. We want them for all the people we know, and actually we probably want them for all the people we don't know as well. It's how we put that into place. How do we manifest that desire? And it certainly can be done without causing harm to anyone else. It can be done in a wholesome way. And I think the way to do that, or one way to think about it from a kind of a critical thinking point of view, is to stay away from the extremes. If we use, well, greed is an extreme, obviously. If we look at the example of the historical Buddha's life, when he, at some point, he decided to give up, you know, the privileged life of a prince, right? He gave that up, picked up his begging bowl, lived as a mendicant for a number of years, you know, traveled around, studied with various teachers and gurus in the area, and at some point, he, as the story goes, he decided that he would deprive himself of everything, give up all creature comforts. And of course, if you think of fasting, in a lot of religion, spiritual practices, it's just a rite of purification. But the story of the Buddha is that he took it to the extreme, almost died, right? He almost died, at some point realized that the way is not found in extremes. It's not found in deprivation. It's not found in greed. And we can follow that same path, right? We can follow the middle way about it. Let me just kind of finish this with one quote from someone who, to the best of my knowledge, was not a practitioner of Buddhism, but a brilliant man, author, playwright named Oscar Wilde. And for those of you who are familiar with Oscar Wilde, you know that he likely struggled quite a bit with desire and want. And this is what he had to say about it. It's Oscar Wilde said, "In life there are two great tragedies. The first great tragedy is not getting what you want. The second great tragedy is getting what you want." I think very insightful commentary on kind of that two-edged sword of desire. And I don't know how Oscar ended up his life dealing with that, but I know that he had some struggles. Let me move on to the second of those poisons, anger. Also very complicated. Anger is, of course, a normal human emotion. We all experience it. It's in our genes. We inherited it from humans 50,000 years ago. It really is a survival tool, in a sense. When you think of the most primitive, for lack of a better word, survival instinct, which we call fight or flight, you've got to have some fight that comes from anger, otherwise it's not going to work. And we have that in us, and we've all experienced it. But the most insidious, so that's kind of a strong word, probably the most difficult part about anger is that when it arises, it is frequently accompanied by a feeling of self-righteousness. We feel justified in our anger. And as we all know, as soon as that feeling of self-righteousness arises, there's trouble coming shortly thereafter, trouble for us and trouble for other people. As some of you know, I made my living when I still worked as a psychologist, a psychotherapist, and lots of people are seen in therapy for issues around regulating their anger. But a few come of their own accord, but most are sent by someone else, family or sometimes the courts, and therapists have really struggled with how to help people with that. For a while, it was thought that maybe the help would come from just instructing people how to vent their anger, how to get it out, and it would be over, but that didn't work. You know, that didn't last very long. The more reasonable approach, and actually, the approach that I think was helpful, was helping the patient identify some of the triggers for that anger, identify some techniques for recognizing it early on, and then using what therapists call cognitive behavioral skills to manage that anger so it doesn't get out of control. Because as we probably have seen, and maybe ourselves and others, once that anger gets rolling, it's very hard to pull it back, right? It tends to run its course, and it's a destructive course. But when the patient was successful with that, they were able to begin to mediate that anger. It gave them an opportunity to look at what was beneath that anger. And of course, as we know, that anger frequently masks hurt, pain, fear. It masks memories of abuse and mistreatment. And it's only when the patient is able to make some peace with that history, usually a traumatic history, that they're able to truly let go of some of the anger. There are some people who, and many people, who hold significant anger at a particular individual, at one person, and for good reason, someone who maybe horribly mistreated them or neglected them. And the habit of having the anger at that person was very destructive. One of the things I was known to say to my patients was holding on to anger at someone is like drinking poison and hoping the other person dies. It really never works out very well. But when anger is, it's a complicated process, and we need to all try to be aware of when it arises in us. And the third of those poisons, which is called ignorance or delusion, Yeah, they're all very complicated. Sometimes you may hear that the enlightened are just those people who recognize their delusions, which makes sense to me. The rub is, how do you recognize your delusions? You know, from a, in a psychologist, a clinical definition of delusion is a fixed false belief. And when that, when you use that terminology, it's pretty hard to let go of it. You know, most of us believe the sky is blue. You know, can we let go of that idea? Maybe. But I'm not really in a position to offer any advice on how to recognize your own delusions, but I can tell you a little bit what I've come to do over these many years. The first thing is to hold the view that all my views are somewhat delusional. Got to be careful with that, because that would include even my view that my views are somewhat delusional would be delusional. But, you know, that cat chasing its tail can be avoided. But if I'm able to do that and I find myself particularly caught up in some idea, some view, particularly ideas about the teachings of the awakened, the Dharma, I'll try to find some time when I can sit with that view and get using some critical thinking, meaning intellectual thinking about it, and try to see if within my view there are elements of impermanence, or excuse me, elements of permanence, or actually my desire that things be permanent, or elements of a separate self, any of those kind of things, then I recognize that it really isn't the Dharma, it's just the way I want it to be. And it's easier for me to just let that pass. But again, it's complicated. And I'm going to just turn very briefly to some other teachings that you're familiar with. They're known as the Bodhisattva precepts, which are often, not often, but sometimes mistakenly thought of as the Buddhist commandments. And they're actually just kind of the inversion of that. I'll just read the first one. The first one, how they're recited here, how they're transmitted here at Dharma Field. Self-nature is clear and obvious. Within the ever-abiding Dharma, not nursing a view of extinction is called the precept of not killing. And of course, it is those, that introductory line. Self-nature is clear and obvious within the ever-abiding Dharma, which reminds us that the Dharma is within us. It's not some external person, the preceptor, whoever, telling us not to kill. It's us seeing for ourselves what is in the Dharma. And of course, there are 10 of those, and they're all the same way. It points out, just be aware of your state of mind. Nothing more than that, just be aware of that. And just that, there's another version of the precepts that I'm familiar with, and maybe some of you are as well. It's how they're recited in the Buddhist order of interbeing. They're actually called the mindfulness trainings. And they're basically follow the same course as the precepts recited here. But I'll just read the first one here just because I find it interesting. Aware, it could probably stop there, right? Just aware, but it continues. Aware of the suffering caused by destruction of life, I am committed to cultivating compassion and learning ways to protect the lives of people, animals, plants, and minerals. I am determined not to kill, not to let others kill, and not to support any act of killing in the world, in my thinking and in my way of life. Again, it's a different way of stating that first grave precept as we describe it here. And again, in the order of interbeing, they're transmitted in the same way. Someone decides that they want to take up those vows, want to take up the precepts. One of the differences is, and I had those mindfulness trainings transmission, you kind of sign a contract, or the certificate they give you says, and if you don't recite these once a month, they're no longer valid. It's just, to me, seemed like kind of an unusual approach, although it really means pay attention to it all the time. You don't retract your precepts, do you, Steve? No. I've always kind of thought, why would that be the case, you know, but it doesn't matter. So, I got a few more minutes. I'm going to actually end with, before we have an opportunity for comments or questions, to talk about a question I have about this talk, and that question is, why wouldn't I say that enlightenment is the most important thing about a Buddhist practice? Well, the reason I wouldn't say it to the general public is then I'd have to explain what enlightenment is, and I don't really want to get into that, because I don't really know, to tell you the truth. But I have a couple thoughts about that. Here's the first one. For those among us who spend every minute, every moment of every day in full awareness of their true nature, their karma, their behavior, their actions, their speech will reflect that state of enlightenment. But for the rest of us, including me, who maybe we've been fortunate enough to have a fleeting glimpse of awareness here or there, but generally continue to struggle with desire, with agitated mind, with delusion, we're probably better off just paying attention to how we live our lives on a day-to-day basis and not worry too much about enlightenment. The other thought I have comes from the Lankanvatra Sutra, and if you're not familiar with that, it's a complicated sutra, but kind of the central theme is non-projection of the Dharma, meaning it cautions against forming ideas, views about the Dharma, creating these cognitive constructs as it is, and then holding them out as if there's something to be grasped at, pursued, rather than understanding that the Dharma exists in yourself. We just have to be aware of that, just have to wake up to that. It's kind of like one of the ancients said, the way is near, but many view it from afar. The way is simple, but many choose to make it complicated. So with that, that's all I have to say. If there's any thoughts or questions. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.